Hello, welcome to Worldview on Engelsberg Ideas. In each episode of these podcasts, we examine a key theme driving our world. With access to the world's leading experts, we explore the past, present, and future. I'm Adam Bolton. In this episode, we're going to talk about the grid, how energy networks store and supply energy needs across the world. The war in Ukraine triggered an emergency in energy markets with global repercussions to varying degrees. But just how well prepared are developed countries such as the United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe to take the hit? And how resilient were the energy sectors at a time of transition to more green energy, with global alliances pledging net zero by as soon as 2030? Is there evidence of real joined-up thinking for sourcing, storing and distributing energy that we all need? I'm going to speak first to Margarita Balmenceda from Harvard. She's at the Ukrainian Research Institute there, and she's also from the Seton Hall University, about the immediate crisis and particularly about the energy situation around the Baltic and those pipelines. And let's start with a basic question. How did Russia come to have and to use the energy pipeline weapon?
Starting in the late 1970s, early 1980s, the Soviet Union, on the one hand, started to move away from developing and producing natural gas in certain areas of Ukraine, started to develop natural gas production areas in Western Siberia. The idea emerged of developing entirely new infrastructure system to export this natural gas. So the export of Soviet natural gas to Western Europe started in the early 1980s. When those natural gas exports started, when that pipeline started to be built under the name of Friendship Pipeline, the pipeline that actually goes through Ukraine, when it started to be built, the US was very much against it. So it kind of reminds me of the situation around Nord Stream 40 years later. The European players, European countries, many of them really wanted these natural gas imports. This had to do with economic reasons. It had to do with certain political views, especially the German leadership at that time was trying to find a way of getting closer to Eastern Germany in the sense of not necessarily a friendship, but in terms of trying to bridge some of the distancing. And they started the policy of Wandel durch Ernährung, change through getting closer. And they believed that buying natural gas from the Soviet Union and tying the Soviet Union to a Western and European economic system and trade relationship would actually help create change within the Soviet Union itself.
It also worked for them as well, didn't it? In as much as it was cheap and it helped them get away from other energy sources.
Yes, but I really enjoyed your question because with your question, you are making us realize and you are making me realize that in many aspects, the situation in the early 1980s had a lot of parallels with the situation in the early 2020s. And in the early 1980s, when the Soviet Union started to export natural gas to Western Europe, there were a variety of reasons why the US was against it. There were a lot of reasons why a variety of European players were in favor of this. And then if you fast forward 40 years, and you get to the discussion about that additional set of pipelines, Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2, a lot of the arguments were similar. But what happened in the 40 years in between, what happened is that the Soviet Union showed itself to be a very reliable supplier. Never mind that there was a Cold War going on in the early 1980s. Never mind that in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there was an entire period of domestic political commotion in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Throughout all of these upheavals, throughout the coldest moments of the Cold War, the Soviet Union was a reliable natural gas supplier. And when the Soviet Union disappears and now the Russian Federation takes over the Russian Ministry of Gas Exports and turns it into a very large company, that company, Gazprom, made sure that it would retain
It's reliability.
Yes, yeah. Supply. And that is interesting. Yes.
And at what point who was it? Was it President Putin start seeing this as a potential weapon, if you like, a potential way of putting pressure on not just Ukraine, but Germany and the West as well?
Well, it's very difficult to answer that because I cannot read his mind. But if you look at the Russian energy strategy to 2025, in 2005, the Russian energy strategy to 2013, 2010, these are energy strategies that are passed a few years after Vladimir Putin comes to power. Already in those energy strategies, there is a great emphasis put on using energy in a strategic manner. What you saw were some more indirect ways of using energy for pressure. So, for example, let's look at Ukraine. I have been studying Ukraine for more than 20 years. So what basically happened with Ukraine, in particular natural gas, is that Russia offered Ukraine already immediately after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, a set of conditions for supplying natural gas that were very competitive, that were very attractive. And this had a number of effects on Ukraine. One effect is that it made it very hard for the country and its leadership to think about moving away from Russian energy because it was so inexpensive. But secondly, the ways in which this trade took place, the way certain things were spelled out or most often not spelled out, the way certain companies, so-called intermediary companies, came to play a role, all of this created a perfect breeding ground for corruption. And in this sense, some people have argued that Russia was already using energy as a weapon vis-a-vis Ukraine by using these energy deals as a way to promote corruption in Ukraine, which is something which, of course, weakened Ukraine from inside.
And Ukraine also had dependency on Soviet-era nuclear power as well, including problematic sites.
Ukraine had a number of nuclear power stations. And obviously the best known of it is the Chernobyl nuclear power station. It continues to have them. These power stations were built during the Soviet period, but manned by Ukrainian citizens for the most part. The way Ukraine became incorporated into the old Soviet Union energy system made it very difficult for Ukrainian elites in the immediate years after independence in 1991 to really think of Ukraine as a country that had to depend on its own in terms of energy. The ties, both at the level of companies, at the level of professional associations, at the level of alumni from famous energy institutions, the conditions under which these supplies were given were so familiar, so comfortable, that this made it very, very difficult for Ukraine to move away from that reliance on Russian energy. And that is a problem because after Ukraine becomes independent, it became basically overnight an energy poor state.
Is it right to say that possibly Germany and countries in the West that have been heavily dependent on Russian energy, Russian gas in particular, may be able to find alternative sources? And certainly the German government is suggesting that it's got enough storage and is taking precautions, but that Ukraine is stuck, really.
Well, that is changing. And it's changing in ways that nobody imagined would be possible. Because when Russia dramatically increased the prices for natural gas in 2010 and 2011, almost by magic, Ukraine decreased its consumption of natural gas by nearly 20%. And as we speak today, Ukraine is on an energy diet, not because it has decided to do so, but because Russia itself is destroying key energy infrastructure. So I have no doubt that with sufficient investments, Ukraine can move away from Russian natural gas and from Russian energy. I have no doubt that it can do that with the necessary investments.
But can they do it this winter? Probably not.
Well, no, but this winter, there are a lot of issues besides dependency on Russian gas. A key issue is that in the last 2 weeks, Russia has destroyed more than 30% of Ukraine's electricity generation.
Exactly. I mean, that's my point, that Russia is still using every aspect of the energy weapon.
Absolutely. And, you know, earlier, a few minutes ago, we spoke about that soft use of energy as a weapon. And now we are talking about the sheer destruction of Ukraine's energy infrastructure. So it's going to be a very, very difficult winter for Ukraine.
Could it bring Ukraine to its knees in terms of suing for some kind of deal with Russia?
I do not think so, because of the way Ukrainians have behaved in the last few months. But I have no doubt that it is the intention of the Russian side to create chaos, to create discontent. We have now a situation in Kyiv and in many parts of Ukraine where not only those attacks of the last 2 weeks have sharply reduced the availability of electricity, they have also brought to a halt supplies of running water. This is something that can make people very unhappy very soon. And I do not know how can that be solved. I think it would be a very, very tough challenge for the Ukrainian government to deal with this.
And what about the measures that have been taken by Germany and other importers outside Ukraine of Russian energy? Basically, have they managed to find alternatives? Has that surprised you?
Well, it surprised me that it took so long for decisive measures to be taken. Obviously, a variety of measures that have been taken to compensate for the Russian natural gas that is not coming in. Two best known measures are the bringing back into online of coal. And the second one is, of course, increasing the purchase of liquefied natural gas. And apparently, they're going to be able to manage this winter. However, and this is a very, very, very big however, this winter, Germany and perhaps other European countries have been helped by the fact that Chinese demand for natural gas, and in particular, Chinese demand for liquefied natural gas, has decreased significantly, about 17 billion cubic meters, because of China's zero COVID policy. That policy has led to the temporary closing of many Chinese factories. This means that Chinese demand for natural gas has gone down. But once that demand is up to what it used to be, that competition will be even keener. So many people are saying that actually the real issue is going to be what's going to happen next winter, even more than this winter.
And as far as you've said already that Ukraine faces a very difficult winter, but you think morale is such that it can be resilient. What about the united front of NATO and particularly Western Europe as the consequences of energy deprivation increase? Do you think that will hold together?
That is a very, very tricky question. So I don't think it's going to be an issue of energy deprivation. It's going to be an issue of prices. A really interesting aspect of this is how different European states are trying to soften the blow to its populations. And what we have seen right now is that you do not have a single European Union policy or a single European Union way of paying for these policies, but you have a smorgasbord of different policies by different states. Germany, the country where I'm spending the year doing research, a few weeks ago unveiled a 200 billion package of support to keep the situation stable over the next 3 years.
And was accused of being selfish by other European members.
Yes. And, you know, whether it's about being selfish or not being selfish, the really important thing here is that when you have one country establishing certain measures for supporting its population, and then another country has a totally different policy, and a third country another policy, all of this really goes against the idea of the European Union as a level playing ground. All of this means that companies in Germany are going to have different conditions of doing business than companies in Spain or elsewhere. And certainly, this is a problem in terms of the reality of what the European Union is or can do. And I am worried that dissatisfaction with German policies, this idea that Germany is being selfish, as in addition to differences concerning whether there should be a special debt facility that would be European Union wide and would be used to pay for these packages, that all of that is going to eat away with solidarity at the European Union level. And on top of this, of course, we have those new elections, those recent elections, those new parties coming to power.
In Italy in particular.
Yes. So these are things that worry me.
But so far there is little sign of any government, if you like, going soft on Russia or on the support for Ukraine, is there?
Yes, but the fall has been quite mild. So I hope, as a supporter of Ukraine, I hope that there will not be a weakening of the coalition, but there are issues that could weaken this coalition. There are a lot of things where we do not see a single European response to this crisis. As you know, in the US, which of course is not the European Union, there are voices in the Republican Party calling for deeper scrutiny of support for Ukraine. And that is a signal that is also being sent to countries in Europe.
If, on the other hand, we're optimistic for a moment and we suggest that Ukraine survives effectively through this, seems to me that Russia might have scored a massive own goal by using the energy weapon, in as much as the West has looked at it and has found alternative sources, and Russia may actually end up, you know, for the next decade or so, not having the levels of revenue which it has enjoyed before, and which, as far as we can understand, have been absolutely vital to underpin its economy.
And that is a great point you're making. That is brilliant, and it's so true. This war of choice has nothing rational in it. It is destroying Ukraine, or is attempting to destroy Ukraine as a state. It is attempting to destroy Ukraine as a nation. It is also laying bare the weakness in many areas of the Russian Federation and of the way governance and even the military works in the Russian Federation. It is increasing ethnic tensions within the Russian Federation. It is destroying demand for those fossil fuels on which leaders like Putin relied to keep the population content. So this war is very, very bad news for Russia. It's the kind of war that, even if Russia were to win it, is destroying the country from inside. And Russia will not win it. That I'm sure of.
That was Dr. Margareta Balanceda of Harvard University. And as we've just been hearing, the best-laid plans have a habit of not quite living up to expectation. According to one Swedish economist, Sweden is a very good example of this unwelcome tendency and experience. He believes that Sweden in the late 1990s had a unique, well-functioning electricity system. It was virtually 100% fossil-free, reliable and cost-efficient. But then things went wrong and there were significant policy changes. Well, Professor Magnus Henriksson of the Research Institute of Industrial Economics in Stockholm joins me now. What went wrong in Sweden?
We had 12 nuclear power plants and half of them have been closed down. I mean, 90% of the population live in the south of Sweden, and these nuclear power plants were in the south, whereas the hydroelectric generation takes place in the north, and there is no way that you can transport hydroelectricity that far without having stable energy production in the south. So now we only have half of the nuclear plants left. And at the same time, government says that electricity consumption is going to double by 2045.
And was a political decision taken not to renew those nuclear power stations?
Yeah, first the two nuclear power stations in the Scania in the very south, they were closed down in the late 1990s in order to get support, the Social Democrats got support from the Centre Party. And then the other four closures have taken place later on in order to get support from the Green Party for various coalition governments, so for the Social Democratic and Green Party coalition.
So no plans to build new nuclear?
Now the government that won the election, they say that they're going to reverse this and build new nuclear. And what you see, of course, is as soon as you see reality with very, very high electricity prices, all of a sudden they're not so interested in having all in wind power and solar power anymore. Then they want nuclear power. So this means that it didn't live up to a reality check, these plans.
So in a sense, the problem you identify with consistency of supply and level of supply, it may be one that if there is a return to nuclear, that could be solved or at least ameliorated.
Yeah, of course. I mean, nowadays, the next generation of nuclear power plants can be built very cost efficiently, and especially the South Koreans are very good at doing that. Then you have stable electricity generation, and electricity will be generated in a few places, whereas if you compare that to wind-generated electricity, you have very dispersed over large areas or out at sea. And the British experience from sea-based wind generator electricity generation is not so good. It cost much more than they said.
And you've got an additional problem with hydro and wind power in Sweden, which is that a lot of time the water is icy, which means you can't operate the wind turbines.
No, on the west coast is fine, and the very south perhaps, but up north, where they plan to use so much electricity doing so-called fossil-free steel, then it's going to be very difficult. And that means that they have to put them on land in very, very sensitive areas. The vegetation and the soil is not amenable to that.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that in spite of the European Union, of course, UK no longer a member, Sweden relatively late joiner, in spite of the European Union, every country has a very different attitude towards their energy balance. I mean, Germany, for example, saying Nein Danke to nuclear pretty strongly. France having a heavy dependence on nuclear power.
Yeah, they have 56 nuclear power plants in operation in France. And of course, Germany is totally dependent on that stable electricity generation by the French nuclear plants. And you can't have your own national policy in this respect, given that the entire grid has been connected and everybody is dependent on everybody else.
That was going to be my next question. What about Sweden getting, I suppose, natural gas and obviously petrol and maybe even coal from other countries? Is that not something that happens to Sweden?
Well, I mean, the idea is that electricity generation should be fossil-free, so coal generation or natural gas generation of electricity is out of the question. But then, of course, since the grid is interconnected, then sometimes we get import electricity from Poland or Estonia or Denmark, which is generated using fossil fuels.
And that grid, that European grid, I mean, again, you're talking about transmitting energy over electricity over long distances.
If you have a stable generation, it's the loss of energy over long distance isn't that big of a problem. It's more of a problem than when you have these intermittent sources like wind energy. Then when there is no wind, when there is no sun, then you're going to have a stable generation that generates as much. And that's really the tricky part and the very costly one.
As things stand, though, you believe with the change of government that Sweden is going on a new nuclear program, but it's present nuclear supply is coming to the end of its natural life. So what are the prospects for Sweden in terms of energy supply, particularly, as you say, with this increase in demand?
The nuclear plants that were closed down, they didn't have to close them down because they were kind of too aged. They did it prematurely. And the thing is that in Sweden, they do things really well. So they put acid in there in order and have already started dismantling them, although they would have been perfectly functional otherwise. Whereas in Japan, for instance, they are much smarter. They have 23 nuclear power plants there that were closed after the Fukushima disaster. But they didn't scrap them. They just kept them. And now they are restarting almost all of them. They were mothballed, whereas we didn't. So therefore, you can't restart those plants that were closed prematurely.
I mean, is Sweden going to run out of energy? You're going to have blackouts?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a great risk of blackouts in the winter. If there's no wind, then you're going to have rotating blackouts. And then, of course, people are going to get really mad.
What about heating in Sweden? Is it generally done by electricity rather than by gas or oil?
Now, many people have take heat from the ground, actually, and some have direct electricity heating, but also we have long distance heating where you get the heating from power plants at a distance. So it varies, but it's more or less fossil free, I would say.
So in that sense, the consequences of the Ukraine conflict are not as grave as they are for most of Western Europe.
No, but the price of electricity in Sweden is, at least in southern Sweden, it becomes the same as the price in Germany. So if the Ukrainian crisis leads to very high natural gas prices in Germany and to scarcity there, then we will get the same high prices as they have in Germany. So we import their prices.
What about energy storage? Because supporters of wind and hydro and solar, they argue that if you could find a way, either chemical or in a battery, of storing the energy, that would get over the problems of intermittency.
I think that if you use all batteries in the world and that's all, you could take electricity from there, it will last for half an hour or something like that. So this is really no solution. And how do you take care of the batteries when you, after you've scrapped them? So that's one problem. The other problem is what they talk about, hydrogen, that you should use wind power to make hydrogen. And then when there is no wind, you should burn the hydrogen and make electricity out of that. But it's very inefficient, so a lot of energy is lost on the way.
Yeah, but as I understand it, something like 30 to 40% of energy generated by new renewables is lost anyway. So in that sense, if you could generate...
But technically there is no full-scale plant of that kind in operation as yet. So we don't really know how much it's going to cost. And hydrogen is very difficult to store. And the efficiency density is low relative to natural gas. So it's unclear whether it's going to be economically viable.
Is that something which Sweden is pursuing or the European Union?
Yeah, the European Union has this hydrogen strategy in order to become fossil free by 2050 or so. And so they put a lot of subsidies into that. And of course, it's not unlikely that we will get a bubble, economic bubble in terms of hydrogen, that a lot of money will go into that and fueled by those subsidies. And then if the technology does not live up to expectations, then of course you will get a crash afterwards, as you have gotten with biogas, for instance, and ethanol, using ethanol instead of gasoline in cars that didn't work out well. Biodiesel, that was not a very good thing either.
Now, you mentioned batteries for storing intermittent energy. People are also talking about what they call LES, large energy storage. Hydrogen is one of the solutions. As I understand it, there are other suggestions, again, which haven't yet been done. Do you see any constructive use for those?
First, there's, of course, a great technological and economic risks. Nobody knows whether it's going to work at full scale. And secondly, you have to think about the opportunity cost. The alternative is the next generation of nuclear power, which is far more safe. And we know how much that's going to cost and that it's going to be cost efficient. And with the next generation of nuclear power plants, you can also use the waste, or again, instead of storing it for 100,000 years. So that's a much safer route to take.
If it's such an answer, why has it not been embraced in Sweden to a large extent and certainly across the European Union?
I think at first in the 1970s, Exxon and other oil companies, they financed a lot of lobbying, anti-nuclear lobbying, because they wanted us to use oil in order to generate electricity in those days. And then, of course, those lobbying efforts have been taken over by the wind power industry. And they are kind of providing lots of arguments against nuclear power and in favor of wind power. And people are much more scared of nuclear power than of wind power and fossil fuel generation, despite the fact that fossil fuel generates electricity, and what it does to air quality kills so many more people. There's lots and lots of people, tens of thousands of people every year, whereas nuclear power plant disasters, they haven't really happened in the West, then haven't killed anybody in the West.
Well, I mean, Three Mile Island, I suppose, would be the first. But since then, there's been Chernobyl and Fukushima, as you say, not in Western Europe, but always things which those opposing nuclear power point to.
First, Chernobyl was not Western technology, and Fukushima, it's bad, of course, that it happened. But first, we can learn from it that the mistake shouldn't be done again. They were below sea level, and they didn't think of that, so therefore they were inundated, and it didn't work out.
What about for nuclear power, the natural resources that are required? Is there sufficient for Sweden or Europe or indeed the world to go nuclear on the scale which you would recommend?
The alternative is very demanding on natural resources, and you have to weigh the alternatives against each other, but there is always a focus on the alternatives that you don't like. You look at all the disadvantages of that without weighing the disadvantages of whatever strategy that you turn to and that you opt for.
And you believe that many of the questions about wastage and storage post-nuclear, I mean, people always talk about a half-life of thousands of years for a lot of this material. You believe that we do have the answers to those?
As far as I've read that the next generation of nuclear can use this waste, and then the problem will become much smaller. And what you see also in democracies in the West, when the price of electricity gets really, really steep, then people change their minds. So this means that if electricity becomes extremely, or energy becomes extremely, extremely expensive and unstable, then people will react to that. And this is what we see already. So if you can have stable electricity generation at very few places, that will also save on the cables and transformers and so on. So it's going to be much more efficient in that way. And something that hasn't been talked about a lot is that the enormous land areas that have to be used, or the sea areas that have to be used in order to capture the wind energy. And it's enormous in the countries like landlocked countries. A large part of those countries' area will be used up for windmills. And I'm pretty sure that once you start saying that and people see that that's going to happen, they won't accept it.
So you would feel in the end that we are likely to have a new nuclear age once we face up to the realities of the alternatives?
Yeah, I think so. And once you have it, if you don't scrap it totally, then still you've got to have all the competence. You've got to have the people who know how to handle it anyway. You see what I mean? So if you have one nuclear power plant, you can just as well have five, because you've got to have the skill to run it and take care of the waste and so on. So that's what I think, yeah.
And economically, are we right to move away from burning fossil fuels?
Yeah, I think so. I believe that we should reduce CO2 emissions. Hopefully, if we can stop it totally, then it's good. So I believe that that's a serious problem that we should really deal with, yes.
So where does that leave us? What policies should we follow in the future to ensure energy security and deliverability? Professor Henriksen has just argued that nuclear power is the answer, and he's expressed scepticism of the potential of renewables. Others take a different view. And joining me now to reflect on the current energy crisis and how they think we can solve it are two science and technology analysts, Olamide Oguntoya and Ariana Kiran Singh, from the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. I asked them first, what are the big issues facing a country like Britain and other European nations when it comes to energy?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. In terms of the energy issues facing Britain and the world at large, it's quite massive and sometimes feels overwhelming as well. But we like to think about it in two big categories. So one is the short-term energy crisis. So, you know, how do you get homes heated up, you know, in this winter? How do you sort of get people, you know, especially those in the bottom category of the income ladder, to afford energy? And, you know, those initial quick short-term issues that we need to address. But beyond that, we have the more long-term, you know, decarbonization targets. You know, Britain has committed to decarbonizing the energy grids by 100% by 2035. There are bigger issues around the electric vehicles coming online. How do we make sure the grid is capable of absorbing those new sorts of energy demand? So There's the short-term ones, which has to be addressed right now, but also the big long-term ones as well, which is where more of the technology and innovation that we talk about come in.
And Arianna, that, I mean, short-term issues are all about hydrocarbons and basically carrying on burning them. I suppose the big question is, are the problems we're looking at long-term because of reasons of climate change we're abandoning, you know, a rather simple and available source of power?
I think that the energy transition has to play a huge part in how we think about electricity and the grid of the future. Burning hydrocarbons, it's not possible and it's not sustainable. And it has also linked us to geopolitical situations that, of course, are hindering our short term as well. Of course, in all the dependency to Russian energy, and even like what the EU is trying to do to cut that link often does not see a solution in, for example, large energy storage, but looks to short-term quick-fire solutions like opening carbon power plants again. The short-term is linked to the long-term and it cannot be decoupled.
Now, just tell us about the grid. You talk about European grid, people talk about interconnectors and all the rest of it. I mean, where do we get our electricity from? How does it work?
The UK, as you probably already know, you know, is a pioneer of grid technology right from the 1800s when the first coal-fired power plants was connected to the grid in 1882 or thereabouts. Britain was, you know, a world leader. And all the way to the early 1900s, you know, where you had many different pockets of generators who were connected to local demand and how, you know, Britain needed to sort of connect all of those different pockets together for a bit more efficiency and sort of have more standardization. So the UK has been a pioneer in grid technology all the way to the time of nuclear power generation in the 1960s and 70s, and of course, to what you have today. So grid technology has been well developed in the UK. At the moment, the generation and the bulk of it comes from gas and wind. So the UK has, you know, the biggest offshore wind assets, as you might know. Coal used to be one of the big ones, but, you know, I mean, in the 1990s, there was a, you know, dash for gas that resulted in privatized energy companies turning down their coal consumption and opting for natural gas because we had more supply coming from the North Sea. So now you have a lot more dependence on gas and also on increasingly on renewables, i.e. offshore wind.
And the other one, of course, particularly in Scotland, is hydro as well. Now, as I see it, I don't know which one of you wants to answer this, the problem is that if we move towards renewables, it's an intermittent power source that it doesn't necessarily give people the constant supply of electricity, which actually is what they need. Some of it's wasted and sometimes it's not there. Would that be the fundamental problem?
Yes, energy storage is the linchpin of what a modern energy system should be, because of course the wind blows, the sun shines, but not all of the time, which is the big problem with intermittent energy. So we need more renewables to hit net zero on one hand, but the intermittent supply becomes an ever-growing problem to energy security. And of course, intermittency of the energy grid is a problem. But in the UK, for example, where we have the largest installed offshore wind capacity, we have 30 to 40% of grid saturation. So there is extra power in the grid, and this goes wasted because you have to have the means to store this energy and then use it when, of course, the wind maybe is not blowing. So large energy storage and energy storage in general has to be coupled with power, with renewables. Otherwise, it won't work.
And if we're talking about large energy storage, you're basically talking about something that would automatically kick into the grid to give consistency of supply, are you?
Yes, energy storage, as you probably know, is what we have in our phones, in our laptops, in our portable electronic devices, i.e. batteries. But when it comes to, I mean, those are very kind of small scale. So when it comes to the grid, you need something much bigger, much larger, that has capacity to supply communities and power them for hours and days, weeks and months. And that's where large energy storage comes in. So it's pretty much a battery in a sense.
It's a big battery.
It's a big battery, yeah.
I mean, in practical terms, when you talk about large energy storage, what are you thinking about?
A range of technologies. The most common one today is pumped storage hydro, which is very simple. When you have excess supply of energy, you use the excess to pump water up the hill. And when you need it, you let the water flow down and drive a turbine to produce energy. So that's how it works. Over 90% of installations today are based on pumped storage hydro. But increasingly, you have batteries, lithium-ion batteries, also being developed into a large-scale grid storage facility. So you have them in Australia, in the US, and also in the UK. But beyond those two technologies, we see a range of other potential opportunities, including liquid metal, pumped thermal storage.
Right. What's liquid metal?
With liquid metal, you can pretty much decouple the capacity of the battery from the power you can generate from the battery. So there's, you know, generally batteries have that difficulty of scale because the amount of power you can store in them is very much integrated to how much power you can get out of them. But liquid metal solve that problem, in which case you then have a bit more scalability and opportunity.
And, I mean, it's a fascinating name, liquid metal. What does it actually mean?
Yeah, but quite a number of other options. So pumped thermal storage, that one gives you the opportunity to not only generate electricity, but also heat as well. So you have a better business case.
And what about hydrogen generation?
Hydrogen generation, yeah, that's another option that is well considered as well. So you have, you know, using excess renewable energy to produce hydrogen.
Sure.
Yeah. And you can store in underground caverns and use them as, you know, source of power when you need them. But also you can use them in real time as they're being produced. And the other advantage is that you can use them to replace natural gas. So most of our homes right now are heated by, you know, natural gas.
And do you see, I mean, there's argument about this, do you see a hydrogen grid as being vulnerable?
There are quite a few, you know, technical hurdles, you know, so things around the lightness of the gas. It's extremely light and, you know, easy to escape. And therefore, you have to reinforce the distribution networks to be able to distribute hydrogen effectively, which means a lot of infrastructure investment. But beyond that, also things around the market and how willing they are to switch as well. So those are some of the issues you contend with hydrogen.
So, I mean, how big or how important, Arianna, do you see large energy storage as being to actually having a functioning net zero grid?
It's absolutely vital. There is no way we can have a secure energy strategy and means of powering our cities and countries without having large energy storage, just because renewable energy is intermittent and we really need a way to fill those gaps. And it's very important, but also very hard to attain because we're very far behind on large energy storage.
I mean, there are people who say, look, this is all nonsense. nuclear power works, provides a constant source of electricity. Why not have that?
Nuclear has its role. And on one hand, you need a source of power that can handle what we call the base load. So that kind of basic demand for energy, which will always be there, come rain, come shine.
Which nuclear can do.
But as you add more renewables, which are more intermittent, more seasonal.
But why bother? Why not just make nuclear work?
I mean, that's an interesting option as well. But, you know, you need something that is a bit more agile and flexible, which is where, you know, renewables come in, because nuclear can't be easily turned off and on, as we have it in the case of others as well.
What do you think about nuclear?
I think it's, as Olamide mentioned, it's great for the base load, but renewables also gives the opportunity of localized grids. It gives closer access to energy. It makes households be able to produce also their energy, put it on the market if they want to. So it opens a lot of other possibilities that also put users and people at the center of the energy transition.
And when you talk about self-generation or localized grids, you're talking about having your own windmill effectively, are you?
Solar panel, windmill, yes.
Now, what about what's going on at the moment? You've written this paper for the Tony Blair Institute, which is a kind of warning signal. I mean, Arianna, I mean, are people paying any attention to you in Britain or indeed around Europe? Are people actually building large energy storage systems?
The answer is yes and no. So we have seen, at least in Europe, some momentum in the large energy storage. The gap is massive and something we need to understand. For example, the large energy storage installed in Europe last year was 1 gigawatt. So 1 gigawatt, you know, it powers around 300,000 homes. But if we want to be net zero, it means installing 190 gigawatts by 2030. So that's 14 gigawatts installation every year. So that shows in a market that installed 1 gigawatt in 1 year. So it's slow momentum, and some of the post-recovery pandemic funds have been used for projects like in Bulgaria and Greece to develop large energy storage, but it's very slow momentum. And I think the EU missed out when they launched the Repower EU strategy to decouple from Russian energy, not giving large energy storage the spotlight that it required.
And what is large energy storage? Is it sort of big building like an Amazon warehouse full of batteries? Is that basically what it is?
So it can be that, and it can be a range of other technologies. So one of them mentioned previously was pump storage hydro.
But that, I mean, that is quite particular to a location, isn't it?
Yes, it's particular to a location.